The information and ideas discussed in this program are intended to be educational and to motivate listeners to take control of their own financial future. Because the subject matter is complex and situations differ widely between individuals, we strongly recommend that you consult qualified professionals before acting on the information discussed in the program.
Hello and welcome to Pro Money Talk. I'm Jason Papier.
And I'm Peter Johnson.
And on today's show, we will be interviewing Jeff Keimer from Stanford Investment Group, and we'll be talking about alternative investments. New listeners to the show should make sure that they go to our website, promoneytalk.com, and sign up for our email list.
Well, we have, an informative show today, talking about investments beyond the normal realm of what most people get involved with. The normal portfolio starts off with things like cash and stocks and bonds, and that's about it. Some of the more progressive portfolios include maybe some securitized real estate, meaning real estate stocks or mutual funds, or maybe they include some foreign stocks. But in this big world of ours, there are other kinds of investments that can make money for people, like being involved in IPOs or being involved in companies that are private companies, angel investing, all kinds of other ways to invest that are not available to everyone and not readily not easy to find information readily about because they're not listed on stock exchanges and so on. So I think today's show gives a high-level overview of some of the other things that are out there, how they're structured, what they're invested in. And I think it's important for our listeners to be aware of these things and not to rush out and see if they can find them or invest in them necessarily, but just to kind of have an idea of what the territory beyond the city limits looks like, if you will, looking out into the wilderness a little bit, into the more adventurous kinds of investments.
At the very least, it's very interesting and informative topic because there's a lot out there and a lot that people are participating in. Now, Stanford Investment Group wanted us to make sure that we mentioned that Stanford Investment Group is not affiliated in any way with Leland Stanford University.
But they do have extensive experience in dealing with alternative investments. In fact, how long has Jeff been doing it?
Well, Jeff's been doing this for 20-plus years.
So that's what you really want to hear is somebody who has some experience with the good, the bad, and the ugly in the investment world and knows what to look for. And they manage enough money that they have good connections, and they have programs that they get involved with, which makes sense. So some of the kind of warnings that he talks about during the show are also, I think, valuable to our listeners.
Right.
I think today's show is a great introduction to the whole subject.
Okay, our interview today is with Jeff Keimer. Jeff works for Stanford Investment Group. And today we're going to be talking about alternative investments. Jeff, thanks for being on the show.
You're welcome.
Jeff, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? How long have you been working with alternative investments?
I entered the financial planning business in 1979, and at that time I didn't realize I was working with alternative investments. That was the hot area back then. Oil and gas drilling programs, real estate partnerships, they were selling quite well. People weren't interested in the stock and bond market. So I started out doing alternatives without really knowing I was doing it, and have been involved in that investment area ever since. During the 90s, I had a period of activity in the venture capital area where I structured a number of private placements for small companies that were working their way towards going public, or at least they hoped they were going to go public, and then have been back in the financial planning area on a full-time basis here since 2000. And I got my CFP designation in 1987.
Now, for those of our listeners who maybe aren't familiar with alternative investments, can you tell us what you mean when we say alternative investment?
Well, in the broadest sense, alternative investment is really just about anything that steps outside of the traditional stock and bond portfolio. So you can have an alternative investment that still is a traded security, like a mutual fund, but is considered an alternative investment because its performance is supposedly going to be less correlated with what's going on in the stock and bond market. So, for example, recently you've seen people starting to use these commodity return funds, commodity index funds. That's an alternative investment, yet it's entirely liquid and you can sell it whenever you'd like, and it's priced regularly. But it's an alternative because its performance is going to contribute to the portfolio in a way that gives you some insulation with what's going on in the whole stock and bond market. Then alternative investments beyond that become more esoteric, where you move into hedge funds, where there's semi-liquidity. But again, the intention is that the manager is generating some type of a return that's somewhat independent of what's going on in the broad markets. Then beyond the hedge funds, you get into alternatives that are private placements in areas where I deem it that you're being paid a rate of return for supplying capital, as opposed to buying a security and turning out to be right, that the security went up in value and you've made money because you've done that. An alternative investment in a business, you're getting a rate of return for having supplied capital. And of course, the most classic example of that is mortgages, where you're lending money to somebody who's, say, doing real estate development, and they're paying you a rate of return in for supplying that capital, which allows them to run their enterprise and create value and sell something that creates a profit for them. And then you can have alternative investments that represent equity ownership in real estate, for example, or equity ownership in the drilling and operating of oil and gas wells. So those are all alternatives. But as you go further out in that spectrum, the main characteristic is they become less liquid or completely illiquid.
So it sounds like this is a really broad spectrum of investments that we're talking about. And the main characteristic, as you mentioned, is that there's a low correlation between the stock and bond markets. Our listeners are fairly familiar with commodities. We've done a show on explaining what commodities are, and I think they understand how they're traded and the ups and downs of commodities. And our listeners also understand the value of diversification.
Mm-hmm.
We've had done quite a bit of explaining the value of diversification on our show. And in case you're a new listener, please go back, and we have a whole show entirely devoted to diversification. So in summary, the benefits of kind of this whole alternative investment class primarily are correlation or are returns or a mix of correlation and returns. What are people looking for?
Well, it should be both. However, there are some advisors I'm aware of who view real estate investment trusts as an alternative investment.
Okay.
And simply because there's data indicating that the returns from REITs are not highly correlated with what's going on in the stock and bond market. If your use of alternative investments is limited to liquid type alternative investments, your contribution to performance can be positive, but it isn't going to be dramatic.
Okay.
And what we do at Stanford Investment Group is a concept of the core part of our portfolio, which is your liquid traded securities, is allocated between large cap, smaller cap, REITs, international, and then fixed income if the person needs it. But we recognize, taking a page out of the book, Swenson's book, Pioneering Portfolios, where you can only expect so much out of that core part of the portfolio. No matter how good your managers are, no matter how many managers you have, you're just going to get what the market gives you, and you hope there's enough alpha there from their positive contribution that you beat the market a bit. But in our opinion, where we really add alpha and where a manager can make a difference is to take client portfolios into this alternative area where you bring in return components that are quite disconnected from what's going on in the stock and bond market.
So this is a pretty specialized field. All financial planners, I'm sure, are not equally adept at using alternative investments. Let's take a step back before we kind of get into the alternative investment. Our listeners know that in all our shows, we're providing information and they need to speak to their financial advisor before they make any moves. But how would a potential client know if their financial advisor is equipped to advise on alternative investments?
Well, it's a good question, because you can easily do some harm to the portfolio here if you don't have the right expertise in this area. So I would encourage anybody who is working with an advisor that's proposing some alternative investments to find out, number one, how long has this advisor had experience in this area, especially as you move off into the illiquid real estate limited liability company, LLC type investments. It's very easy to make a mistake in that area. And of course, being illiquid, you can't change your mind and sell and get out as you can with a fund that you've bought or a stock that you've bought you decide you don't like. So it's a positive for the portfolio, and you need to quiz your advisor carefully as to how much experience they've had in this area before you start adding alternatives to the portfolio. As a matter of fact, in Swenson's book with the Yale Endowment, he has that core part of the portfolio down to about one-third traditional market investments, and two-thirds are alternatives. And he's doing things like venture capital, oil and gas, leveraged buyouts, real estate. And when the book first came out, he became concerned because he thought people were going too far in this area without the access that he has. And, of course, with a large multi-billion dollar type endowment, he has access to the really top sponsors of these alternative investments. The average person on the street, unfortunately, does not have very good access to good alternative investments, especially in the illiquid area.
There's also something to be said for transparency, and there's certainly a lot less of it in the alternative investment world, so it makes it more difficult for those who aren't experts in alternative investments to make wise decisions.
Yes, exactly so. Our company here is part of a due diligence organization that looks at the illiquid alternative investments. Matter of fact, it's been going now for 25 years. And back in the 80s, when real estate was really a hot item, we saw a number of sponsors of what you could call an alternative investment coming out and raising huge amounts of money because everybody wanted to get in on real estate. And a lot of those partnership-type investments came to grief. With the market now being less generous in the returns it's offering, we are seeing the emergence of more offerings from people that we think are in the business of raising money as opposed to being in the business of really sponsoring real estate offerings most generally. And we're seeing more glossy brochures and appeals to investors to put their $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 into this huge fund that's going to own all these different income real estate properties and how wonderful it's going to be for their portfolio. I don't think that necessarily those investors are going to lose money in those programs, but I think that they're not going to get the rate of return commensurate with the illiquidity that they're taking, mostly because they've raised so much money, the sponsors simply can't find enough real estate to buy. There are such huge offering expenses on the front end, they end up working with 80-cent dollars after they pay their offering costs, that they're at a huge handicap to buy the right kind of income real estate that'll make those partnerships work. So, yeah, you bring up a very good point. There are alternative investments, and there are alternative investments, and you need to be careful which one you're getting.
So we've talked about the potential illiquidity of an alternative investment. We've talked about potential gaps in knowledge or non-transparency in the alternative investment world. And you mentioned limited partnerships. That was something that were certainly popular in the 80s and got raised a lot of money and got a really bad name.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier, you also mentioned hedge funds, and there's some potential for hedge funds. Everyone's hearing about hedge funds. There's some potential for hedge funds to fall in that same trap.
Yep.
As it relates to alternative investments, can you explain a hedge fund and sort of what you see in the landscape there?
Well, it's a huge, huge subject, and the number of hedge funds out there has grown exponentially in the last 10 or 15 years, and it's also very difficult to generalize when it comes to hedge funds. There are some hedge funds which are quite conservative and have been structured to basically be a surrogate for a bond, to generate a bond type of return without having as much exposure and sensitivity to interest rate changes. At the other end of the spectrum, you can have highly leveraged hedge funds that are employing some type of financial strategy where they think they have found some market inefficiency and they're arbitraging differences in currency exchange rates or something like that. And if there's a change in the marketplace, you can quickly have huge losses. So it's hard to generalize on it. I would say that the really good hedge funds have very high minimum investments, like $1 million plus. And as you see hedge funds being packaged for the average investor, where the minimums are getting down to $25,000, that gives me great concern. Typically, it means that the sponsor who needs to go to the trouble to get a $25,000 investor in the door must not have a very good following of investors, because the really good hedge funds are practically closed. So you need to be careful. There are some what they call fund of funds out there with hedge funds where they're making it available to somebody for $25,000 or $100,000 or $150,000, and then they pull together multiple millions of dollars, which are then invested in these upper-tier hedge funds that have million-dollar minimums. The problem there is you've got two layers of fees involved. You've got the fee and the profit share at the source-level hedge fund, and then the guy in the middle who's put the fund of funds together, he's got some expenses, he's got his share of fees. You put that in there, and it creates a great burden on that underlying hedge fund to generate a rate of return that's going to be adequate to make it worth that risk and trouble you took to go into the fund of funds.
So you're talking a lot about risk, and we've talked a little bit about what the major risks are. There's a concept of a risk premium.
Yes.
Can you explain to our listeners that concept and how it relates?
Well, I'll explain it as I understand it. You take a look at your risk-free investment, which typically is your 10-year treasury, and you say, okay, what's the rate of return I'm getting for going into this other investment, which is going to be more risky, and how much extra return am I going to get over the 10-year treasury for having done that? So with the alternative investment, especially those that are illiquid, you're taking the liquidity risk. You can't change your mind, as I mentioned earlier. So you want to see a rate of return that's well in excess of what the risk-free rate of return is, and also add something to your portfolio in terms of this non-correlation that I mentioned earlier. Alternative investments really should be used as part of an overall portfolio strategy. You should not just focus on alternative investments because, gee, I can get a 10 or 15% potential rate of return. Why would I have anything in my portfolio that can do 4 or 5? You've got to have a blend. At Stanford Investment Group, we think that for the right clients who have a large enough portfolio, that the amount allocated to illiquid alternative investments or semi-liquid alternative investments can range anywhere from 10% to maybe 30% on the upside, unless there's a special circumstance where somebody has a very large portfolio and can afford to put more into the illiquid part of it.
So you have to have the free cash flow.
This money should be money that you can go the duration with the investment, unless it's a mutual fund that we've deemed to be an alternative investment, like a commodity fund where you could sell it tomorrow if you needed to.
Okay. Now, can alternative investments be used in all types of accounts? Can you have alternative investments in your retirement account? And I know it's a broad term. So when we're talking about alternative investments at this point, let's not talk about the commodity mutual funds and those sorts of traded funds, but let's talk about the illiquid funds or the illiquid assets.
Yeah.
Illiquid investments.
An illiquid alternative investment should be appropriately structured to go into a retirement plan, and we have used some of them in accounts. When you're in a retirement plan, there is an issue called unrelated business taxable income, and it specifically has to do with owning partnership shares or LLC shares of investments that are where leverage is involved. And in real estate, there's typically a mortgage. And that can mean that the taxable income, rather than being tax-free in your IRA or your retirement plan, can generate a taxable income for you. So the best way to have an alternative investment that's in that category in a retirement plan is to have it structured as a note. And we have seen sponsors that have structured participating notes where there is an alternative element. They are getting the risk premium that we're looking for, but it all comes through as 1099 interest income, which creates no UBTI problems in their retirement plan.
Okay. Are there any restrictions in other types of plans, whether they be trusts or just or personal accounts?
No, most trusts are written pretty broadly so that they can participate in just about any security they want. I would encourage a business owner who has a pension plan where he has employee participants in the plan to keep that plan pretty much on the straight and narrow. And any alternative investments that they do there should be the liquid trading types. Because if you have illiquid notes or things in there, you have the problem of valuing your pension plan at the end of each year. If you have an employee leave, they want to get their share of the pension plan, you have alternative investments in there that are not market priced, it becomes very dicey as to how you value them. And in the worst case, if you had a problem with one of those investments, you could have a plan participant saying that you shouldn't have invested in that. So retirement plans that go into alternative investments should be self-directed, sole participant plans.
Good. One of the appealing things maybe in a retirement plan is that alternative investments have the potential for higher returns, and of course retirement plans are tax deferred typically.
Mm-hmm.
The other potential benefit, especially for younger people, are that retirement plans are long term in nature. So let's talk about the nature of alternative investments and the time horizon.
Mm-hmm.
In alternative investments, when someone if someone's interested in an alternative investment in general, what time frame are they looking at?
Well, again, talking about other than those of mutual funds where you can, you know, hold it for a week if you so chose, when you move into the other alternative category, I'd say that it'll run the range from 2 to 3 years at the minimum, which might be some kind of a special note, a real estate secured note that has a 3-year duration, up to equity investments where they're building a piece of real estate and going to rent it up and sell it, which could take 4 years, 5 years, to buying a piece of real estate where they're going to operate it for a number of years and increase the net operating income and create value by doing that and selling it. And there you should anticipate being in it anywhere from 7 to 10 years. And some alternative investments, for example, oil and gas drilling programs that we have a lot of experience in, and I would say are very difficult to find good ones. We've only found one that we like and use. That's a business where the money is expended to drill the wells and create the production, and then you live with those wells through their life until their production is finally down to the point that they sell off the wells. So you have a bell-shaped curve of cash flow coming out of that program. And there you've got to be in for the duration. There really is no selling your shares unless somebody comes in and buys the wells, which we had happen the beginning of this year here. So the sum total, when you move into the illiquid area, you're looking for 3 to 10 years plus.
You're talking about, you mentioned real estate, you've talked about commodities, you've talked about these energy. What are the more popular, I suppose, alternative investments available?
Well, again, other than the mutual fund type things, real estate is probably the largest. There's a huge amount of real estate out in the country. And also, it's very difficult to generalize about real estate. People talk about, you know, is the real estate market overvalued? Is there going to be a collapse in the real estate market? And real estate are local markets. So you could have a situation where in Southern California, you wouldn't want to go in and buy and own an office building, whereas in Chicago, you might have a great opportunity right now. So you can't generalize on real estate, which is really the good news, because it ties into one of the other major tenets for doing alternative investments, is that is to find inefficiencies in the market, opportunities. The stock market and bond market are very efficient. The knowledge is widely dispersed. The argument's made that everybody knows the same thing at the same time. You move into the alternative areas, and there are opportunities to capitalize on an inefficiency in the market, a seller who's gotten themselves into trouble with a piece of real estate, and they need somebody to come in and buy them out quickly. Well, if you're with the right real estate sponsor and they have the capital and the expertise to come in and take advantage of that, you can make money off of that opportunity. So the most alternative investment opportunities are probably going to be in the real estate area, whether they're lending programs or equity ownership programs. There are some other alternatives out there that I didn't mention that I don't think are really viable, and they have to do with leasing, where partnerships have raised money to lease aircraft, to lease medical equipment, containers that go on ships. Quite frankly, I think that's somebody just looking for somebody else to supply the capital for an asset that they don't want to tie money up in, because it's a depreciating asset, a wasting asset. And a long time ago in the 80s, I had some experience with leasing programs, and the initial cash flow was good, and then the cash flow started to go away, and then you found out the asset wasn't worth anything. So leasing as an alternative may be out there, but I don't think it's a good one.
Private equity is this idea of people pulling money together, and you talked a little bit about it at the beginning, to buy into businesses. As our listeners know, we were at the Financial Planning Association conference last week in San Diego, and I listened to an interesting talk by an investment banker. He was talking about the private equity market, how it's really exploded, and there's frankly a lot of money out there. That adds some danger, I would imagine. In other words, the more money out there, they have to find places to invest.
Yeah. Well, and it brings to mind a comment I should have made earlier. In the investment world in general, the expression, you know, who you invest with is everything, is true. And when it comes to mutual funds, you want to have a really good manager. Well, when it comes to alternative investments, you really want to be hooked up with the right person. So as more money becomes available, especially for alternative investment sponsors who have money-raising machines, have a great reputation and the money can come in, they do face the problem of raising more money than they can intelligently deploy. So that's another thing that anyone interested in alternative investment should be looking at is the sponsor of this alternative investment raising the money because there's truly an opportunity, or are they raising the money because they can raise the money and then they're going to look for the opportunity to deploy the capital, or they're going to be forced to deploy it into low-yield situations which don't meet the objectives?
And this goes back to making sure that the investment advisor that you have or the person that you're working with is really knowledgeable.
Really knowledgeable and has established some relationships over the years with the better sponsors. There are sponsors out there right now who will take money from anybody and everybody because they're raising $3 billion in a huge real estate fund. I wouldn't be interested in putting money into that. Again, not because I think the clients would necessarily lose money, but they wouldn't get a rate of return. They wouldn't get that risk premium commensurate with the illiquidity they'd be taking. Just to add, Jason, to your comments about the risks, as there's more and more interest in these alternative areas, because we've been doing these for so long, we've established relationships with a number of real estate sponsors. And these are people that come to us after they found a building and they want to raise the money for it. They aren't raising the money and then going out and looking for buildings. But all of them at a conference we went to in June where they were assembled to talk to us said that the prices that they see some of these large publicly registered partnerships that are raising billions of dollars to go out and buy real estate, the prices that they're willing to pay for these properties are just out of sight in their opinion. And it's frustrating to them because they can't find anything to buy that meets their metrics, but these other programs are willing to go buy. And what it means is that the cap rates on those buildings are going to generate a return such that the net to the investors in those large programs is going to be in the mid to low single digits. It's going to be a bond-like rate of return, and yet they're going to have taken the risks of being in real estate and the illiquidity risk of this large program. So it's a concern, and interestingly, too, we have a couple of our real estate sponsors that are selling their buildings to these larger funds. They have decided that everything in our portfolio is for sale. The prices are so good right now, we're going to sell.
Well, that tells us something
about the
investment environment out there.
Yeah, timing is everything.
So when you're looking at real estate investments in this alternative investment world, how would somebody know if their advisor knows enough about the real estate to be able to make good decisions?
Well, that's a good question, Jason. I think the advisor should be able to explain to you or answer the question that you put to him, what is the capitalization rate or cap rate on this building being purchased? It is the metric that drives all income real estate purchases. And for somebody who doesn't understand what cap rate is, it's simply if you owned the property free and clear with no debt, and you had the gross rents coming in, and you had the operating expenses, and you had the net operating income left over, if you owned the property free and clear, that would be the rate of return on your investment. And cap rates vary based on the type of building, the location, and desirability of the building. What's happening out there right now, and your advisor should be able to answer this question, is we're seeing sponsors that are buying buildings with cap rates in the 6%, 5%, or maybe even lower range. Well, if the sponsor has organizational expenses such that not all the money that he raises get into the property, and the building itself is only generating 5%, and maybe he's got a mortgage at 5%, all the building can do is service its debt and generate 4% or 3% on the investor money coming in. So a good test is to see whether or not the advisor understands cap rates.
Yeah, it's interesting in the area that we live in, Silicon Valley. Talk to a lot of property brokers, and cap rates traditionally have been closer to the 10 level, and they're in some cases down to 4. And again, cap rates are a function of the price of a property and how much income it's producing.
Right. And when you buy a piece of real estate, the way that they make money is by increasing the revenues, by raising the rents. And then if it's the same capitalization rate, the property becomes worth more. That's what makes the value of income real estate go up versus your house. Your house, the price is driven by how many people want to live where you live. Income real estate is a very different dynamic.
So what type of people, what type of investor can benefit from alternative investments? And what kind of investor are alternative investments maybe not the right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think even a rather small portfolio can make use of REITs. And I think the time is a number of people have been writing some articles about how a good commodity index type fund can produce equity-like returns with a low correlation to what's going on in the equity market. They're liquid, and you can bring them into most all portfolios. To start to move out into the illiquid alternative investment area, I'd say the portfolio should be north of $1 million, personally. I think it should be there. I see some people doing it at less than that, and if it's done intelligently, possibly so. But I would feel more comfortable that the net investment assets for the client, the portfolio, not his net worth, including the equity in his home, but his net investment assets are $1 million or better.
Okay.
And then you'd be very careful about how much it is, and you start out with the lower risk alternative investments.
So starting with $1 million, that's sort of the entry level is what you're saying. And even from there, we're going to look at low risk alternative investments.
Illiquid alternatives, yeah.
Low risk, illiquid alternative right. investments, mm-hmm. and a lower percentage of the portfolio in alternative investments.
Right. Again, now it depends on the person's circumstances. If they're high income and generating all the cash flow they need and they have $1 million portfolio, you could see them having a larger allocation to alternatives. If this person's approaching retirement and they've got $1 million portfolio, well, they may do no illiquid alternative investments because it just simply doesn't fit.
So we're looking at things like we look at with all investments. We're looking at time horizon, how long someone has to invest. Mm-hmm. We're looking at what we call risk profile, how much risk that person can afford to take in their portfolio.
And I think you're also looking at personal temperament, too. A client needs to understand that when they move into this illiquid area, there can be hiccups. There can be problems with programs where they're longer than expected, or the difficulties might even require for a real estate project. They might come back and say, we need to raise some more money. We're offering a special note offering. Would you like to put in some additional money to help us bridge us through this difficult time? The economy's been softer. We had that happen with a very large real estate development back in the north part of Chicago that's doing quite nicely now, but they came on the market just as the tech boom was collapsing, and an office building they had did not rent up as quickly as they thought it would. And so in order to bridge that gap, they came out to the investors and offered a senior note, paid 10% interest or something like that. And the risk on it was pretty low because it was first in line after the mortgage to get paid off, and we felt there was enough equity there. So some of the investors kicked in more money. They bridged that time. They got the occupancy up. They refinanced the building, and they paid off these notes. You need an investor who can take a letter from the sponsor saying we're raising more money because things are a little tough right now, and not get panicked about that.
Mm-hmm. And the alternative investment world is so broad, as you've mentioned, that there are asset classes within the alternative investment world, and a good alternative investment manager will know what asset classes may be overpriced in that world and what asset classes may not be overpriced.
That's
in that
correct.
World.
Yep.
In the current investment environment, a lot of analysts are saying that the best people can hope for in equities are single-digit returns. Obviously, real estate is something that a lot of people are talking about. Is it going to slow down? Is it not going to slow down? Bonds haven't produced great returns lately. Going forward, I think that there's going to be a lot of interest in alternative investments. There's going to be a lot of buzz about alternative investments, primarily as a way to increase investment returns. Do you see that? And if so, is there a danger in that?
Oh, I see it, and there definitely is a danger. In the years, in the 90s, especially towards the latter part of the 90s, many of the alternative investment sponsors out there simply couldn't get the attention of the advisors. Hey, I'm doing 20% on mutual funds. Why do I need to fool around with your real estate program? And when the clients are getting nice double-digit returns, that 1% management fee or whatever is being charged doesn't seem so expensive. But when you're looking, as you say, at market returns that are in the single digit, that 1% management fee or something less than that really starts to hurt. So the manager is pressed to try and find something to increase the return in the portfolio. And that scares me because all of these can be made to look very good on the front end. The packaging can be nice. The story can be very compelling. And you can easily think that, yep, I've done my homework and I'm putting my client into a good investment, and you can be disappointed quite easily.
As interest increases and money increases, we're likely to see more and more money going into bad alternative investments, perhaps, just as we saw in the 90s money going into bad equities. And it isn't until a pullback that a lot of people realize what was bad and what wasn't bad.
Yeah. And as I said before, the problem with many of the alternatives is you can't sell when you've decided that, oh, I don't like this anymore. You're in it for the duration.
Okay, so final words. Do you have any advice for our listeners who are interested in exploring this idea of alternative investments?
Well, I think it can be an important part of the portfolio, especially in times like this, which are really uncertain. I know everyone says these are difficult times, but right now there really is, I don't think, any more intelligent approach than to diversify, but to realize that doing something outside of that traditional core portfolio of stocks and bonds becomes more important. I'm thinking, too, of an alternative investment that could take advantage of currency changes. There are people who believe that our dollar is going to be under pressure. There are mutual funds that have been constructed to take advantage of that. You could argue that that's an alternative investment. So, yeah, I think that it would be important to diversify, get good managers, and to judiciously add alternatives in selected situations.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. Once again, we were speaking with Jeff Keimer from Stanford Investment Group. And if anyone is interested in contacting you, Jeff, or contacting Stanford Investment Group, how would they do so?
Well, they can go to the internet. We have a website. It's www.stanfordinvestment.com. And if you want to send me an email, it's jeff@stanfordinvestment.com.
All right. Well, we appreciate you being on the show. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for today. Thanks to Jeff Keimer and Stanford Investment Group. Make sure to go to our website at promoneytalk.com and sign up for our email alerts.
And I'm still looking for those success stories. I've got some coming down the pike. We'll probably have some audio interviews as well as me just sharing with you people's stories. But whether it's a small or a large success, if you know someone or you yourself have achieved some financial goal, from balancing a budget to having a comfortable retirement or a change in lifestyle that you managed to finance, it's really inspirational to other people to hear those stories, and it's also educational.
You can also get to us on the website by clicking on the link, Ask Us a Question.
Good, and we are definitely looking for your questions as well.
All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed the show this week. I'm Jason Papier.
I'm Peter Johnson.
And here's to your success.